A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on December 22, 2002, entitled, The Deeper Truth of Incarnation. The texts for the sermon are 1 John 1, verses 1 through 4, and chapter 4, verses 7 through 8, and John chapter 1, verses 1 through 5, and 14 through 18. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
The title of the sermon this morning invites you to think with me about incarnation and a deeper understanding of it. It's not because I have discovered something about incarnation that is brand new. It is rather that I am recognizing more and more that the old familiar truth of incarnation has become so familiar to us that I think we fail to see, to understand its radicality and the revolutionary nature of that claim. Incarnation, the eternal Word. In the beginning was the Word, John begins the Gospel. In the beginning was the Word, and someone has translated that, in the beginning was the intention. And I like that. The divine intention. There was something in the beginning, some intentionality in this whole creative process. So in the beginning was the divine intention, and then in the 14th verse, and that divine intention became flesh, human nature. The radicality of that claim is amazing. Luke tells us the story in a beautiful fashion of the birth of the child, the mother, the angels, the shepherds, and all. But John is of a philosophical bent of mind, and so he sets this event in the vast cosmic context, and he reflects on it philosophically or theologically. You would be well advised to stick with the storytellers. Theologians are boring, but then such is my lot. So it's John this morning. The Word became flesh. That's a radical claim. Yesterday, all day long, the house was filled with a marvelous aroma. And at supper time, Nancy fixed me a bowl of chili con carne. We often speak about chili, as everybody knows, but it's really chili con carne. And con carne comes from the Latin, of course. Con is the preposition with, and carne is meat. We are, those of us who haven't cleaned up our act and become vegetarians, we are carnivores, meat eaters, carnivorous. I love it. And I look like it. Carnival. You'd never identify that word with chili con carne, but as a matter of fact, carnival is a carne vale. Farewell. Farewell to red meat. Farewell to meat. Carnival time is a time to let out all the stops and get all that juice out of you, because you're about to enter into a fast where you're going to have to be solemn and serious. And so the carnival, Mardi Gras is that, the carnival. Farewell to flesh. The incarnation means that what we really have to deal with is God con carne. God con carne. I thought I'd get a little more reaction than that. It's a little bit crass, but you should never forget it. Christmas is God con carne. Christmas is God with flesh on. And the central truth expressed so powerfully in John's gospel and reiterated in the letters of John, which emanate from that Johannine circle somehow or other, how could you make it any more concrete than those opening sentences of that first letter? We declare to you what was from the beginning, what we have heard, what we have seen with our eyes, what we have looked at and touched with our hands of the word of life. John was intent on expressing the fact that God has come to expression in human nature, in humanity, that the human is the embodiment of God, the enfleshment of God. We've always, from time immemorial, have wanted some clue about God. Hasn't there always been that question in the depths of the human spirit? Who is God? Where is God? What is God? What is ultimate? What is the mysterious foundation of all that is? Why is there something other than nothing? And certainly John knew that. In the 14th chapter, we have that little conversation between Jesus and Philip. And Jesus had been talking about going to the Father, and Philip says, "Well, Lord, just show us the Father and we'll be satisfied." And Jesus says to him, "Philip, have I been with you so long and you still don't get it?" Jesus said to Philip, "If you have seen me," what? You can talk in church. "If you have seen me, you have seen the Father." Of course. Philip, don't you get it? Here I am, God in your midst. The embodiment, the enfleshment of God in your midst. Philip, you want to see the Father, you want to understand the Father, you want to know the clue as to the mystery of that which is ultimate? Touch me. Look in my face. For I am the only God you'll ever know. Because the amazing claim of our gospel is that the eternal intention has become enfleshed in a human being. And so in the first chapter, the prologue, to go back to that moment, in that 18th verse, which I dealt with sometime or other not so long ago here, no one has ever seen God. Once again, there it is, you see. No one has ever seen God. But the only Son has made God known. And as I think I said at that time, someone again has translated that in a rather marvelous fashion. The discipline we learn in seminary is the science or the art of exegesis. You take a text and you break it apart and you open it up and you try to explain it. You interpret it. That's what I'm doing as we speak. Exegesis, it's an academic discipline which hopefully would prepare the preacher for opening the text for the people. And what that 18th verse has been translated by someone else who says that no one has seen God. The only Son is the exegesis of the Father. That's wonderful. The Son breaks open the mystery that is God. So this is what Christmas is about. This is what the central act of Christmas is about. The embodiment, the enfleshment of God in the human. You say to me, that's not a deeper understanding. That's the same old thing we always heard. And that's true. But let me remind you of what I've been circling around in these last weeks and last Advent season particularly. I cannot believe that I had lived all my life, Advent after Advent after Advent, and had not recognized the contradiction, the conflict between the mirror of God in the incarnation and the mirror of God in the second coming. For in Advent, we so easily say that the one who came is coming again. And then it struck me that the image of God that we have revealed in the life of Jesus from the crib to the cross, that life of poverty and obscurity, of humility, of grace, of compassion, the vulnerability of the child, the vulnerability of the one who was crucified. There is a picture of God, and that we have claimed. But how do we put that together with a God revealed in that one who will come again, the one who came in poverty and obscurity, coming again in power and great glory? So that it would seem that one who came in poverty and humility came from another realm into our realm, took up temporary residence, took on our flesh temporarily, and then left again, having accomplished redemption in order that we might find our way to be delivered from this realm into another realm. The two realms, the dualism, and the God revealed in that child, that God is still apparently above the fray and still in control and still calling the shots. But as a matter of fact, the God revealed in the child, in the vulnerability of the child, that God has given up control. That God who has been embodied in the human is the God who creates us in freedom, beckoning us to love in turn. And as we said last week, that's precisely the risk of love. Love doesn't have any guarantees. If you have a world where might makes right, then you can coerce and you can have your way. If God runs the universe that way, then God can have God's way. But if God indeed emptied God's self, and if the infinite has become concrete in the finite, so that you can touch and handle the Word made flesh, then that kind of vulnerability brings with it no guarantee. Love can be defeated. Love can be crucified. And the image of that God is quite other than the God who will move from the wings into the main stage and call down the curtain on history and execute the judgment on the living and the dead. That God never gave up control. That God in Jesus remained God very much. I am suggesting to you that the deeper understanding of the incarnation may be that the God revealed in Bethlehem's child is the real genius of the Christian understanding, but that the church couldn't live very long with a vulnerable God, because what we want is a God who is strong and in control, the Lord God Almighty. Now, Now you just think about this with me, because I'm plowing some new ground here, and I'm not at all sure that I am totally sure that I haven't got all the loose ends gathered up, but I'm finding a new way to think about God and speak about God as I see God revealed in Jesus in the incarnation, and simply stop there. Because I think there's a major distortion that has occurred in the history of the church, and it began very early. It began with that apocalyptic expectation in the immediate aftermath of Jesus. That apocalyptic expectation that expected the heavens to open and to God to come down and to wreak judgment on the world. I'm suggesting to you a deeper understanding of the incarnation is that the original intention was to say, oh my God, God is like that. That the intention of the incarnation in the heart of the Christian proclamation was to portray a God of vulnerability, because that God would create the likes of us in freedom, beckoning us to love. It seems to me that the mistake the church made was to say that what happened in Jesus happened once for all, one for all. When as a matter of fact, the initial encounter with him by those who touched him, who looked upon him, who listened to him, was to say, my God, and to realize that God was in the human. We are in this cosmic process of billions of years, big bang, stars exploding, elements cooling, planets forming, in a most amazing fashion beyond our ability to fathom it. And it seems to me that the deeper understanding of the incarnation is that after billions and billions and billions of years, maybe like 3 million years ago, life happens. And then maybe a million years ago, something similar to human life begins to form. And then eventually it comes to the likes of us on the edge of the third millennium, where we can sit in an assembly like this and we can think about billions of years and cosmic reality and star explosions. We can realize that what has happened, we have become, do you realize the amazing thing that is ours, the privilege that is ours, that we have come to a point where we have become aware of that whole thing, aware of that whole process, learning more about it all the time, knowing very little about its deep mysteries, but knowing that we are the product of that process that has been underway. Here we are thinking about it. We human beings become the consciousness of the cosmos. We human beings become the awareness. The cosmos becomes aware in us. We human beings have the voice of praise and stand in wonder of the cosmos. That is an amazing thing. And it seems to me the deeper understanding of the incarnation would be that that process goes along and along and along and along for billions and billions and billions of years, and one day somebody, some creature, wakes up and becomes aware to the point at which we are today, where the awareness just continues to grow. And the understanding of the incarnation is that the infinite, that creative spirit, whatever, however you want to speak of that ultimate mystery, that infinity becomes concrete now in the finitude of the likes of us. Finitude, matter, which has spirit. Finitude, matter, which thinks, which knows, which understands, which becomes aware. And is not the miracle of Christmas, that is the coming into flesh of God? Is that not the concretization of that creative spirit in form that you can get a hold of? The church wanted to say all of that of Jesus, but only of Jesus. And then the rest of us, just poor middling human beings trudging through this veil of tears, waiting to be redeemed in order that we might be exited to that other realm. You see the dualism of that traditional conception? God sends the Son. The Son takes up temporary residence in our flesh. And then after the incarnation, there's an excarnation. And the purpose of the incarnation was not to enable us to be the bearers of divinity, but rather to deliver us from this mundane veil of tears. And oh, dear God, we've missed the glory of it. We've missed the wonder of it. We sit around here waiting. We wait for the next act of God. We wait for the clouds to open and for God to speak in dramatic fashion and to right the wrongs and bring history to its consummation and to make things right. And that's not going to happen. God has acted. God has become human. The human is the bearer of God. The incarnation is a reality. It is an ongoing reality. We are the extension of the incarnation. We cry out, "How long, O Lord, how long?" And I suppose that God would resoundingly cry, "How long, how long, how long indeed? When will you get it? You are it." And I think the writer of that first letter had something like this in mind, for after in the opening paragraph saying God is just that tangible, in that fourth chapter he says God is love. And then he repeats from the Gospel's first chapter, "No one has ever seen God." But then he adds flesh to it. He says, "But the one who dwells in love dwells in God, and God dwells in that one." And a few lines later, "The one who abides in love abides in God, and God in that one." In other words, humanity is the bearer of divinity. And it is the one who has learned to love in whom that divinity dwells in full expression. Well, I shouldn't say full expression. Tentative expression, inadequate expression, flawed expression. But nonetheless, here and there, now and again, something about Jesus, the flesh of Jesus, the person of Jesus, caused those who saw him, who walked with him, who were encountered by him, to say, "My God." And that wasn't the end, it was only the beginning. It wasn't once for all in that one place, but what is true, every place in all time. That the whole process has been tending toward this, that the whole cosmic process is issuing in spirit, spirit marked by love, for God is love. And the world lies in such darkness, and there is such grief and such pain. And it is only in the midst of that darkness, when the human embraces me, that I can feel the embrace of God. When another looks into my eyes and says, I care, I love, that I look into the face of God. It sounds like naive preacher talk, the kind of silly sentimental stuff you would expect at Christmas. Well, it's your fault you came to church at Christmas time. I've been preaching so long now, and I question myself harping about this all the time, you know? Because someone might say to me, don't you know the real world out there? Don't you know how dark it is? You're saying that that human animal is a God bearer. You're saying that the only God accessible, visible, tangible is the God in flesh in the human? And I have to say yes. Because I believe that Jesus Christ is the way and the truth and the life. And no one will ever experience the ultimate mystery except in the way of Jesus, which is the way of love, of self-emptying love. The deeper truth of the incarnation is a radicality of that divinity in humanity that is crying to come to expression. But we can't live with that very long, because then it's in our hands. Then it's up to us. Then we have to change the world. And as I said, once in a while, I just smile at myself, ranting on like this in such naive fashion. Except the real naivete is to think that the kingdom will come in any other way, through power or might or glory, that finally, with the exercise of muscle, we can bring in the kingdom. That finally we can establish an empire once for all with freedom and justice for all. No. Fear controls. Power coerces. Love transforms. And once in a while, I get on Sunday night a fax. This one said, Dick, following is a bit of verse that fits with your sermon this morning. I believe the original stimulus was one of your Wednesday evening Advent messages a year ago. You'll also find a number of thoughts borrowed from your sermons. What if we loved one another? What if we Christians, Muslims, and Jews loved one another? What if we Christians, Hindus, and Buddhists loved one another? What if we Christians, Confucians, and agnostics loved one another? What if we evangelicals, fundamentalists, and liberals loved one another? What if God's people of all faiths loved one another? Would we miss the illusion of superiority? Would we miss the exhilaration of judging others? Would we miss the view from higher moral ground? Would we miss the thrill of killing them with swords or words? What if we, white and black, loved one another? What if we, black and yellow, loved one another? What if we, yellow, red, and brown, loved one another? What if we, Europeans, Asians, Africans, and Latinos, loved one another? What if God's children of every color and nation loved one another? Would we miss the illusion of superiority? Would we miss the exhilaration of judging others? Would we miss the view from higher moral ground? Would we miss the thrill of killing them with swords or words? What if we, old and young, loved one another? What if we, single and married, loved one another? What if we, with and without academic degrees, loved one another? What if we, straight and gay, loved one another? What if we, female and male, loved one another? What if we, blue collar and white collar, loved one another? What if God's daughters and sons of every label loved one another? Would we miss the illusion of superiority? Would we miss the exhilaration of judging others? Would we miss the view from higher moral ground? Would we miss the thrill of killing them with swords and words? 9/11 showed us what love's absence can do. The days after 9/11 have shown us what happens when love is activated. Superiority stifled by the quiet but tireless power of humility. Judgment overruled by the celebration of diversity that enriches us. Higher ground held only by those tired, dusty heroes who emptied themselves in service. Blood-red battlefields transformed into green meadows of mercy and healing. What if we loved one another? What if we started with simple respect? What if we humans become what we were intended to be? Would God's people of all faith languages worship in unison? Would God's children of every color compose one picture? Would God's daughters and sons of every label celebrate as siblings? Would we then finally understand the meaning of incarnation, of God with us, of God in us, of human divinity?